Joining us, as we have the privilege of welcoming Dr. Sajeev John, the recipient of the 2014 Canada Council Killam Prize to the University of Calgary. This is the third year that the university has hosted a Killam Prize winner, and we are so pleased to have Dr. John speak to us this evening about the age of photonics, semiconductors of light, and their practical application for the future. I would now like to introduce President Elizabeth Cannon, who will bring greetings on behalf of the University of Calgary. Dr. Cannon is a passionate advocate for the importance of higher education in driving discovery and innovation, finding solutions for the world's greatest challenges, and fostering the talents of young women and men who will become our future leaders. In her first year as president, Dr. Cannon launched the most extensive consultation process ever taken at the University of Calgary. The goal was to develop a roadmap for the future based on shared vision and dream of what the university could be to the city, the country, and to the world. Part of that vision is partnering with key community stakeholders like the Killam Trust to bring eminent Canadian scientists like Dr. John to our university. I'm now pleased to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Cannon.
Thank you very much, Brian, and good evening and welcome to the EEL building at the University of Calgary. I would like to extend a particularly warm welcome to Dr. Anne McCaig, representing the Killam Trust here this evening. Of course, our special guest, Dr. Sajeev John, our distinguished speaker. I know we also have Dr. John Mason, our visiting Killam scholar here, members of our Board of Governors, our Senate, and also members from our senior leadership team, including our Vice President Research, Ed McCauley, and our Dean of the Faculty of Graduate Studies, Lisa Young. I also want to thank members of the University of Calgary community, our students, our faculty, and staff, to come out and hear what I know will be just a wonderful lecture this evening, that it's going to expand our horizons and our perceptions. This is the third Killam lecture here at the University of Calgary, and we are so privileged to be part of not only the Killam family, but this wonderful program. As you know, and as we will hear a little bit later from Dr. McCaig, this program brings Killam Prize winners who have been recognized for their outstanding scholarship and achievement in a number of areas spanning humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, health sciences, and engineering to each of the five Killam universities. These awards are truly some of the most important and prestigious academic awards in our country. This year, as noted, we have the privilege from hearing from Dr. Sajeev John, Professor of Physics at the University of Toronto and Canada Research Chair in Optical Sciences. Dr. John is a pioneer in his field, whose work in photonic bandgap materials, sometimes referred to as semiconductors of light, has tremendous potential in the field of physics, chemistry, engineering, and medicine. This aligns very well with some of the research that we're doing here at the University of Calgary in one of our areas of research strength, new Earth space technology. We are proud to be home to researchers working collaboratively across disciplines to create new technologies for improving global communication, networks, and environmental monitoring. Research innovation is absolutely essential to our economy and to our quality of life. The Eyes High vision at the University of Calgary is about recognizing and growing excellence in everything we do. We aspire through our vision to be a global intellectual hub in Canada's most enterprising city. And it's bringing people like Dr. John to our campus who are leaders in their field to inspire us through their work and through their accomplishments. We have prioritized research excellence, high quality teaching and learning, as well as contributing to our surrounding community as fundamental commitments to our Eyes High vision. The partnership between the University of Calgary and the Killam Trust enhances our ability to succeed in our goals. And I cannot understate how important it is that the encouragement that we get through the Killam Trust and the trustees is very dear to us as an institution. It supports excellence across the board. So I want to thank you, Anne, and all of the other trustees for your wonderful encouragement and support. I would now like to introduce Killam Trustee, Dr. Ann McCaig. Ann has served the Killam Trust for over 20 years. She's a passionate advocate for youth, education, and health, who works tirelessly to ensure the highest possible quality of life for future generations. She serves as a director of the Gairdner Foundation, former director of the Banff Center Foundation, chair of the Calgary Health Trust Board of Directors, and honorary chair of the Alberta Bone and Joint Health Institute. The impact that Anne has had in our community and her selfless dedication to philanthropy and volunteerism is a true inspiration. Of course, we count Anne as part of the University of Calgary community because she is Chancellor Emeritus of our institution. She was an active member in that role of our campus community. She was a member of our Board of Governors and, of course, received our highest honor, an honorary degree from the University of Calgary. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Ann McCaig.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. It's always wonderful, Dr. Can and I should say. We've known each other for such a long time. In fact, back, I can remember when you were head of the department, then dean, and one of the things that I remember the most about Dr. Cannon is how she encouraged women in engineering, and that was her program, and you've made it into such a wonderful, wonderful success story, as you've done with almost everything at the university. So thank you for that kind introduction. So good evening. I'm delighted to welcome you here and bring greetings from the Killam Trustees. The trustees are from Halifax, George Cooper, who is the managing trustee of the Killam Trusts, Dr. Kevin Lynch from Toronto, Dr. John Montabano from Vancouver, and myself from Calgary. There are only four trustees. There have always only been four trustees. And there always will be four trustees. That's just how they've set it up. And I'm very privileged to be one of those. So we'd like to express, though, our sincere congratulations to this evening's guest speaker, Dr. Sajeev John, the 2014 Canada Council Killam Prize winner in natural sciences. Dr. John is definitely a bright light in Canada's research community. And his work has led to many exciting discoveries, which I'm looking forward to learning more about this evening. Dr. John, welcome to the university. Welcome to Calgary. Tonight's event is part of a special five-year Killam initiative, wherein our prize-winning scholars take part in a lecture tour of the Killam institutions, as the president has said. Ryan also mentioned that this is the third in a series of lectures that will occur at the University of Calgary. Part of this initiative and the first year that the Faculty of Science has hosted a winner. When I drive into the university, as I did this evening, I'm just delighted to be here, and it's lovely to be on this campus. As Chancellor Emeritus and former board member of the Board of Governors, I've had a long and very rewarding association with this university. From 1990 to 93, I was vice chair of the U of C's Building on the Vision campaign, and in the mid-90s, I had the privilege of co-chairing the Delivering Results campaign for the Faculty of Management. These two campaigns raised a total of $61 million, a great accomplishment at the time, but one that seemed so small in the comparison to what President Cannon and her team have currently undertaken on behalf of the University of Calgary. And I want to congratulate you, President Cannon, for your commitment to continuing to build a great university in our city. I'm a firm believer in the importance of lifelong learning, and I value all of our places of higher learning, but the students, faculty, and staff at the University of Calgary will always have a very special place in my heart. I'm particularly proud that the U of C is one of the five Killam universities in our country, an accomplishment that goes well beyond benefiting the university. It's also an impact to the broader community. Simply put, our city is better and stronger because we have a Killam University. And just before Dr. John comes to speak to us, I want to tell you a little bit about what that means. I have found most people, even staff and students at Killam Universities, are not always aware of just how much the Killam gifts have transformed education and research in all of Canada. The market value of the Killam Trusts stands at about $425 million, which is approximately the size of the Rhodes Trust in England and the Nobel Foundation in Sweden. In other words, it's very, very significant. Since being established in 1965, the Killam Trusts have awarded 108 prizes and close to 6,000 fellowships and scholarships. The Trust also provides funds to the 5 designated universities for Killam chairs, professors' salaries, and general university purposes. The founders of the Killam Trustees were Isaac and Dorothy Killam. Isaac Killam was born in 1885 in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. Mr. Killam was one of Canada's most eminent financiers who got his start as a paperboy and went on to become head of the Royal Securities, the first Canadian stock brokerage firm to be opened east of Montreal in the early 1920s. Mr. Killam was a very reserved man who avoided publicity and was virtually unknown outside a small circle of very close acquaintances. As the saying goes, opposites attract. And Mrs. Killam was most definitely the complete opposite of her husband. She was born in St. Louis, Missouri, in 1899. Mrs. Killam was an extrovert who absolutely loved people. Yet as different as they were in personality, the Killams shared a common sense of business savvy and a bold vision to transform the quality of education and research in our country. Having no children, it was the Killams' desire to invest a greater part of their wealth in higher education in Canada. When Mr. Killam died in 1955, he left Mrs. Killam $50 million, and she proceeded to multiply that handsomely. Remember, that's 1965, so just do the math. And in her will, Mrs. Killam wrote, "My purpose in establishing the Killam Trusts is to help in building Canada's future by encouraging advanced study. I hope in some measure to increase the scientific and scholastic attainments of Canadians, to develop and expand the work of Canadian universities, and to promote sympathetic understanding between Canadians and people of other cultures." Interestingly, a book was written to tell a Killam story, and it's entitled A Very Private Person. As a new trustee, I received the book, I read it with great enthusiasm, and I found there was one very bad shortcoming, and that was that they hardly mentioned Mrs. Killam at all. Knowing the significant part that Mrs. Killam played in building the financial dynasty, and that she possessed her own passion for education, I felt compelled to mention this omission often to my fellow trustees. My interest in this matter may have had something to do with the fact that I was the first female appointed as trustee, still am the only female appointed as trustee, a privilege I have enjoyed for the last 20 years. I'm very proud to say a rewrite has since been done, and his story has been expanded now to include her story. The generosity and foresight of the Killams sparked the beginning of a glorious new age of research at Canadian universities, and the legacy they left behind has a dramatic impact on our community. When Mrs. Killam died, 10 years after Mr. Killam, she left their combined estates now worth $100 million to specific education purposes and institutions, as well as a large gift to the Isaac Walton Killam Hospital for Children in Halifax. At that time, only a few Canadian universities sponsored graduate and postgraduate research programs. Most Canadian scholars who wanted to learn or earn a PhD degree or pursue doctoral work had to leave Canada for other countries, mainly the USA and the UK. The Killams had realized that this brain drain was holding Canada back, and their determination to stop it led them to devote their fortunes to higher education in Canada. They especially wanted to help universities in the regions of Canada where Mr. Killam made his money. and where advanced research existed only in the embryonic state. Today, the Canada Council Prize is known as one of Canada's most distinguished research awards. Each year, five prizes of $100,000 are awarded to eminent scholars in humanities, social sciences, natural sciences, health, and engineering. It's significant to note that the Killam scholarships and prizes are awarded strictly on merit. No consideration of race, religion, national origin, or gender enter into the competition. The Killams wanted to ensure Canada would be a country where scientists, scholars, and students have the freedom and the opportunity to study the world around them, pursue answers to their questions, and pass on their learning to others. Thank you for joining us tonight to enjoy one of the more expressive parts of Killam's vision to promote rigorous scientific study in Canada and to showcase the results locally, nationally, and around the world. Thank you.
Thank you, President Cannon and Mrs. McCaig. We have an informative and engaging program planned for the evening, and I want to give you a quick glimpse of what you can expect tonight. Shortly, we will welcome Dr. John to give a brief presentation, and then we'll move into a conversation portion of the evening. And that's where Dr. John will sit down and delve deeper into the subject matter with Dr. David Cram. After that, we'll open up the conversation to you, a time for some questions and answers before the closing reception. They've already mentioned Dr. David Cram will be moderating the conversation. Before I hand the microphone over to him to introduce Dr. John, a little bit about David. He's currently the head of the Department of Chemistry within the Faculty of Science, and he's also the director of our nanoscience program. Between coordinating undergraduate classes and mentoring graduate students, he's published over 60 manuscripts. He studies the behavior of nanoparticles in blood vessels, and his group has developed sophisticated fluorescent spectroscopy technology that's used to analyze complex nanoparticle mixtures, and this approach is unique to the world. He's a great conversationalist. He's passionate about his work and the world around him. Please welcome Dr. David Cram.
You may note the resemblance to George Strombolopoulos, but it probably ends when I start talking. My speaking notes have largely been spoken, so I won't delay this much except to add a couple of notes about Dr. Sajeev John, who I'm sure you'll enjoy a fantastic talk from and hopefully a great conversation with. So the ideas that he's about to talk about tonight start with his PhD work at Harvard University, where he started to ask simple but interesting questions like, can you trap light in a similar way that you could trap electrons? And he's of the belief that sometimes when you ask simple questions but delve into them really deeply, extraordinary answers evolve out of that process. He's currently a professor of physics at the University of Toronto and a Canada Research Chair in Optical Sciences. And so please join me in welcoming Professor Sajeev John.
Well, good evening, and thank you very much for those kind introductions. It's really a pleasure to visit the University of Calgary, and a privilege for me to take this stage as your Killam lecturer this year. And I'm deeply indebted to the Killam family and their trust for the legacy they leave to our nation's intellectual prosperity and economic prosperity as well. So, before we start our conversation for the evening, I thought I'd just give you a brief introduction to the subject that I work on. As David mentioned, as a graduate student, I asked a very innocent question, and that was whether one could trap light. Light is something that is ubiquitous, it pervades our experience no matter what background we come from, and it's really surprising that something so commonplace can yet be the source of scientific discovery and at the same time have novel practical applications. And asking this question led me to a new class of optical materials, which are known as photonic bandgap materials. And some have called these the analogs of the semiconductors of light. Materials have played such an important role throughout our history that we name entire eras after the dominant material of the time, starting from the Stone Age, the Bronze Age. The 20th century you might think of as the age of electronics, where we develop materials that can control the flow of electrons and perform certain functions. Now, it wasn't long ago when my son, who was only 5 years old at the time, asked me whether I could explain a little bit of what I'm doing to him. And so I was very pleased to hear that, and I tried to do that. And he was very quick to reply to me that, "Papa, that just doesn't sound very interesting," at least when compared to what he's accustomed to seeing at the movie theater. And so I've been working on trying to fix that problem ever since. So here you see some illustrations of photonic crystals. They're floating through space, but never mind that. These are periodic structures. Unit cell that comprises the periodic unit contains typically about a billion atoms, and it might be made out of a material such as silicon. You see another structure here, which is called the woodpile structure, which has been made in various groups around the world. Actually, in Toronto, that first structure that is called an inverse opal was fabricated for the first time. And the next structure that'll come up shortly was actually one that was invented here in Alberta. It's a spiraling structure, all of which have this capability that if you put light into them, you can trap it and you can guide it in ways that have never been possible before. Now, in order to trap light, one of the first ideas was that you should simply create a structure that scatters it a lot. And structures that scatter light are very common and familiar to us. For example, if you look at the clouds, water droplets are randomly scattering light, sort of like those red spheres. It's not quite as dense as I show there. And the direction of light just gets randomized. And the idea is that if you could scatter it a lot, then the light would just bounce back on itself and eventually get trapped. Now, the condition under which that happens is something that doesn't occur in nature, because as you see in that right-hand picture, the light propagates a certain distance and then its direction is changed, and that's referred to as the mean free path. And in order to trap light, we would have to make a material that scatters so strongly, and various examples are showing up here, the snowbank, the clouds, etc. We would have to make it scatter so strongly that its mean free path becomes shorter than the wavelength of light itself. So if you take a typical opaque material, say the palm of my hand, if you were to send light at a wavelength of 1 micron into that, the mean free path would be more than 1,000 times that wavelength. It's about 1 millimeter. In other words, in order to trap light, you would have to create a material that is nearly 10,000 times more opaque than any naturally occurring material. And these materials that scatter light and don't absorb it have this color of white. Another type of structure that you could make is, rather than a random one, something which has periodic order. And here again you see that various colors appear. So I started with the monarch butterfly, and this is just a magnification of what's inside of its wing. And as you magnify further and further, you actually see this periodic or repeating motif that creates scattering and interference of light. An example from my home country is the peacock feather, where if you take enlargements of the wing, what you see is a three-dimensional periodic arrangement of the structure. Now, these structures are sort of disordered photonic crystals, but they don't scatter strongly enough to trap light. To do that, we have to go to what are called artificial structures, such as I've drawn on the right-hand panel, one-dimensional periodic structures The middle one is a two-dimensional periodic array, and the bottom one is one in which there's three-dimensional periodicity. And what I found was that if you combine the underlying periodicity with a certain amount of disorder, that is exactly what you need to trap light, and you have to make it out of a material which has a very high index of refraction so that it can scatter light, for example, materials such as silicon. And if you do that, what you get is something like this. This is a picture inside of a photonic crystal, or also called a photonic bandgap material. You see an ordered array of what are silicon pillars. The disorder in this case is just removing one of the silicon pillars in the middle. And this is a mathematical solution of the famous equations written by Maxwell in 1865, showing a completely trapped or localized state of light. Maxwell told us that light consists of oscillating electric and magnetic fields. So the red and green arrows are the electric and magnetic fields. It's interesting to look at the size scale here. The center-to-center distance between these dielectric rods is 600 nanometers, less than a micron. And if you want to think about what that means, the typical thickness of a human hair is slightly less than 100 microns. So this whole picture would easily fit within one single human hair. A couple of the novel features of this is that the light is confined on the scale of its wavelength, and it can be trapped in a region where there is an absence of that silicon material. In fact, you can trap it in air, and that's a very unusual way of confining light. Usually when you confine light, you do it by something called total internal reflection, which means that you have to hold it in the high refractive index region. And that is the backbone of much of today's internet, the optical fibers that guide light over long distance by this mechanism of total internal reflection that is bouncing back and forth around the boundaries of the fiber. These photonic crystals have already been implemented in fiber optics, and I show you some illustrations of that. Here you see various cases where a periodic array of holes has been embedded along the axis of the fiber. And as a result of that, you can have a hollow core, and the light can actually be guided inside of that, not by this total internal reflection mechanism, but by this photonic band gap trapping mechanism, which is based on interference. So this was considered as a very important thing in possible optical communications. It would change the allowed bandwidth for sending laser light pulses. It's not restricted by the bandwidth of silica glass, since now you could propagate in air. And you can engineer the profile of light in the core. These are different mode profiles that you could do. So you could mold the flow of light in very special and unexpected ways. This actually came to a very unexpected application in 2004, which actually turned out to be the first life-saving application in the field of clinical medicine. This was actually a patient in a Boston area hospital who had this condition called a recurrent respiratory papilloma. It's a tumor that keeps recurring inside the trachea. Here's a normal trachea and one which is blocked by this type of tumor. And since it recurs over and over again, it was treated by laser surgery. And that typically requires an incision and line-of-sight propagation of a high-intensity laser beam to ablate this tumor. This patient had undergone so many such treatments that she couldn't actually withstand the trauma associated for another such invasive procedure. So the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. approved the use of this type of hollow core photonic bandgap fiber, which could guide very high intensity light through a flexible endoscope through the mouth, and that was used to successfully treat and manage this tumor. You might ask, why don't you just use an ordinary fiber? Well, in an ordinary fiber with a solid core, the intensity of light would be so high it would damage the fiber before it got to the tumor. But by having a hollow core, being able to guide it in a way that one never thought could be possible allowed this procedure to happen. And now tens of thousands of such procedures have taken place. Here you see a three-dimensional photonic band gap structure. We've talked about just one and two-dimensional structure so far. It's a little bit more complicated to synthesize. This is one that we actually created for the first time at the University of Toronto. It looks like a collection of, if you play golf, wiffle balls that have formed into a lattice structure. The radius of each of these spheres is 850 nanometers, just slightly less than a micron. And within this structure, it's possible to trap light at a wavelength of 1.5 microns, the wavelength of choice in telecommunications. And so this is one that we showed that you could do by the method of self-assembly, which had not been utilized before in making these three-dimensional photonic crystals with an actual band gap. And one of the journalists that covered this referred this to this very nicely, like a house full of windows, but from which light cannot escape. So it's really still a bit of a challenge making these structures. Here are some of the requirements. You need a high refractive index. It should be a very pure and non-absorbing material, as well as have a very precise architecture. If you deviate much from the architecture, you won't be able to trap the light anymore. And for practical applications, of course, you have to mass produce it at a cost of a few pennies. So you might think that's pretty much impossible if you consider the intricacy of these structures. But this is a challenge that has occurred over and over again in the history of science and technology. In fact, even when Edison was making his first light bulbs, a lot of people thought that this is something that's so costly that only the rich or a small niche of people would ever use. And that brought a retort from Edison that he would make the light bulb so cheap that only the rich could afford to burn candles, that being the technology that came before. And so we're still in that stage, if you like, as far as some of these three-dimensional photonic crystals are concerned, that we can make them, but we have to be able to make them much more efficiently and at a low cost. This is a different architecture for a photonic crystal based on this so-called woodpile architecture. And in that woodpile architecture, you can leave out certain silicon rods, and these play the role of waveguides or circuit pads in which light can flow on this very microscopic scale. And in a moment, you'll actually see a computer-generated solution of the Maxwell's equations as light flows through this optical chip. And one of the aims of this is to be able to manipulate light on this microscopic level so that one could perform functions such as computing or information processing on an optical chip, rather than on the traditional electronic chip. In electronics, you would have only a single channel of information flowing through each of the circuit paths. With light, you can have hundreds of different wavelength channels propagating simultaneously through each of these channels. For electronics, as electrons flow through their circuit path, there's resistance, and that generates heat. And as a result, you need a chip fan to blow off the heat that's being generated, and if you try to compress too many transistors onto the chip, the whole silicon material would melt. Here, the light does not experience that type of resistance, and that cooling system that's usually required in supercomputers would not be required. And another application of these optical microchips is one thing that we're starting to look at is for, again, clinical medicine use it as an optical biosensor in which various disease markers attach to the interior surfaces of the photonic crystal, and then you shine light through it, and that yields a spectral fingerprint of various proteins that might have attached to antibodies that you place on the surfaces to trap the disease markers. A third and final application that I'll mention, which again is of some very recent interest, is the possibility of higher efficiency photovoltaics or solar energy harvesting using this concept of trapping light. Now, what is the problem with current day solar energy conversion, or silicon-based solar cells, what I plot here as a function of the wavelength is the spectrum of sunlight that arrives on the surface of the Earth. And in the black, what I show is the absorption spectrum of crystalline silicon. It means that crystalline silicon absorbs very well at short wavelengths, but most of the rest of the spectrum going from, say, the green to the red and near infrared, very little absorption takes place. And so to make up for that, what people have to do is to create a solar cell with a very thick piece of silicon, typically on the order of 300 microns. Now, you might not think of that as being thick, but for solar cells, that is. And sunlight comes in, it creates an excitation in the silicon. An electron is excited to a higher level, leaving behind a hole. These then move through the silicon structure until they reach a point which is called the junction between the P and N type silicon. And once they cross that junction, they're home free and they can go around the circuit to provide power to an external load. But if you make the silicon very thick, there's a strong chance that these guys won't make it to the contact. They may just recombine and give the light back. So it is useful if you could make a really thin solar cell. You could not only make it more efficient, but it could also be much cheaper. And here are some pictures of some of the designs that are currently being considered using photonic crystals. The idea here is that by creating a periodic array of silicon, such as I've shown here in these nano wire arrays, each of these wires is a few hundred nanometers in thickness, so this whole thing is much smaller than the size of a hair, you can cause the light that was very weakly absorbed to be deflected into the latter direction, bounce around many times, and basically slow down so there's enough time for the silicon to absorb it. And by doing that, with less than a micron, that is a factor of 300 less silicon, you can absorb practically 90% of the sunlight that's available over the range of 400 nanometers to about 1100 nanometers. This is another structure in which you see these cone-like holes, again, arranged in this square lattice. Sunlight comes in, it's deflected into the lateral direction where it propagates in very slow moods, bouncing back and forth, and gets absorbed before it can just be reflected back or transmitted through the structure using a very small amount of material. And the aim is if one could make a thin film solar cell made out of silicon with a 30% electrical solar to electrical power conversion efficiency, that would be a real industry game changer, I think. Okay, so I hope I've given you a little bit of a sense of what I mean by the question of light trapping, and I hope I've given you some of the reasons why it's valuable to trap light in the long term, looking for ways of processing optical information on a very small chip, replacing some of the functions of electronic chips that way. Some of the things that have already been implemented, these photonic crystal fibers used already in clinical medicine, something that is coming up fairly soon in the energy sector of high-efficiency solar to electrical power conversion using a different type of light-trapping capability of these thin films. And one thing that I'm hoping to do in the near future is to develop this idea of doing medical diagnostics for this lab-on-chip optical biosensor. Instead of sending a blood sample away to a lab, you can just put a very tiny sample onto a chip, shine a laser beam through it, and immediately get a diagnosis of certain diseases. And I should say, finally, that this is very fundamental science still, and it's fundamental science that is achievable under relatively ordinary conditions that are common to human experience. It doesn't require extreme temperatures, extreme energy scales, or extreme isolation. And as a result of that, I think that there are going to be a number of additional applications that we haven't even thought about. And with that, I will continue with our conversation, I hope. Thank you.
too. Or the next half hour is going to be very awkward. So maybe let me indulge my inner science geek a little bit. So I've scribbling down some things based on this fabulous talk. And the imagery in it really is, I found striking, for sure. And it seems to me the one of the challenges right now is materials fabrication. The fact that it traps light, that these crystals, does that mean you can't use light to fabricate them?
Actually, you can use light in a special way, because if you take a couple of different laser beams and interfere them, you can create a pattern of light intensity that has the architecture of one of these photonic crystals, remarkably. That's something that was discovered in the last 6 years or so. And you can imprint that onto a photosensitive material, such as a polymer, and make a polymer replica of that pattern. And we have learned through our colleagues in materials chemistry how to go from that polymer template to a silicon structure. So it is true that you can use light. That's probably the best way of making these materials now.
Yeah. One for the team, eh?
Yeah.
Well, my follow-up was going to be, and maybe this is still a relevant question, is there, like often we steal ideas from nature, because
yes,
nature's had millions of years to perfect
right.
Catalytic reactions. Is there nature-inspired materials that we can draw from in the fabrication process?
Yes and no. I mean, photonic crystals were studied long before we realized that there were examples of photonic crystals in nature. And so like the peacock wing is a very nice example of that. And you could use that as a template actually to then replicate into a material such as silicon. It would be somewhat too disordered for a lot of practical applications. But you're right, in a sense we are sort of, you know, looking at the artistry right in nature and understanding it and just developing it a little bit further, perfecting it to the level that we can bring out a practical application. So observing what happens in nature is really very important, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So just remind everybody, in case you showed up late, I'm not sure if anybody has, but there will be a session of Q&A after I'm done grilling Professor John. Not grilling. And you've got little notebooks, so if you had burning questions that came up during the talk or during part of our conversation, make sure you note them down for yourselves so that you don't lose that train of thought, and then we'll get to you. And there'll be a reception afterwards, too, where you can also further ask those questions. So now I'm going to maybe get away from the science part a little bit and further indulge my curiosity. Part of what makes science so interesting for me of late is when a scientist has that aha moment. And I'm wondering, in the evolution of the process of trying to understand trapped light, was there a moment for you where you understood you were really on to something?
Yeah, I would say that there was a pretty well-defined moment. As a PhD student, I sort of brought this subject of trapping light from complete impossibility to at least to plausibility. And then later, I was hired at Princeton University by a Nobel laureate by the name of Philip Anderson, who did his work on electronic localization. So he was betting that this is actually going to work out. But soon after I got there, high temperature superconductors appeared on the scene. So they all disappeared and were working away on that. I was left alone sitting in my office on a cold January morning thinking about this. And that's when it really dawned on me that the missing ingredient was putting order into the structure. So far, everyone had been thinking about just disorder as a way of trapping light, random structures. But if you could balance some order with disorder, that was the key to robustly and very easily trapping light. And yeah, that I was really taken by that, and you know, my heart was pounding, and I was wondering what should I do now? Should I just keep it a secret and try to publish it right away, or should I try it out on somebody? Eventually, I decided, okay, why not try it out on somebody? And to my amazement, nobody wanted to steal the idea because they didn't quite get what I'm talking about. So it's actually very safe to speak freely if you have a eureka
crazy
moment.
Crazy ideas, yeah. That's a great story. So did that moment come naturally? In the sense that it sounded like you'd been thinking about the process a lot and maybe returning to the idea again and again. Was it like a visionary apparition to you, or did you feel it coming on?
No, it comes in unexpected ways. I mean, I was really thinking about whether I could make this work. I was almost ready to give up at some point, but it was just a matter of observing things that are going on in some other areas and then correlating them and understanding, well, how does, the states in the gap of an electronic semiconductor get localized? That seems to happen very easily, and everyone is focusing on the fact that it's disorder, but underlying that was order. That's where we started from. So that's really where the insight came from, reading and working on some other problems at the same time.
Right, yeah. Having a really solid physics and math background, that must have helped a lot in taking the ideas to the next step.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You have to know what the rules of the game are, otherwise you're likely to violate them very quickly.
I'm wondering, too, if you have a mechanism or a way to encourage your students to allow themselves the freedom of thought that you had, like if you have a feeling for whether there's a way or an environment to encourage those eureka moments in your own research group, for example.
Yeah, I think that's really important to develop as part of our teaching. I know that when I studied physics, it was a little bit more dry. Here are the rules, the laws of physics, and just go and solve some problems with them, and that proves that you understand it. There was never an attempt to, relive the moment, like when Einstein came up with relativity. What was he really thinking, and what were the pressures that he faced from outside? And, he was just making a very simple observation, looking at Maxwell's equations and realizing that it allows for propagation of light in empty space. And, most people would just say ho-hum to that. I mean, and I asked my students, would that bother you that a wave can propagate in nothing? But that was the key insight that made him think that the speed of light is the same no matter what the observer is moving with velocity. So I like to now at least, pause for a moment when I'm teaching the subject to ask the students, would you have thought that? Would you have even had the courage to say it? That's part of the eureka moment, not just having it, but being able to, say it under conditions that people are willing to receive it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it seems returning to the question again and again, persistence maybe, I guess, is an important factor as well. And I know out there in the real world, the industry is trying to encourage innovation and trying to set up environments that inspire innovation. I wonder if you think that there's something that we can learn from each other in our perhaps different approaches to innovation and creativity, industry versus academia.
Yeah, I think there is. I've actually been asked to give seminars at some big companies as part of their creativity training program, so to speak. And on the other hand, I think we can also learn something from them. I mean, their work is for a very specific purpose, and it's tested whether that really is of benefit to society when a product goes to market. Sometimes, we start in the university based on just curiosity-driven research, and I'm very happy that it starts that way, but at some point one might want to look for that higher purpose that it might fit into. So maybe we do have something to learn from industry as they have to learn from us as well. Yeah.
I'm sure our VP research is hearing music right now. So interesting that you mentioned these processes and what goes on in Einstein's mind, for example. I've got two teenage boys, and I often wonder what's going on in their mind. And sometimes it's fairly impenetrable. And you've got an interesting familial background, having a father who is a research physicist and a mother as a biochemist. How did that influence the person that you became? Were you always a scientist, almost genetically?
Well, let me say that, my calling to be a professional hockey player fizzled out pretty quickly. At some point, you gotta learn how to skate and do it when there are five other guys trying to prevent you. And that just didn't work out for me, unfortunately. So it was then it was physics or medicine, basically, and I chose physics, and that one actually stuck. Although some of those hockey skills actually can be helpful even when you're doing physics. I don't mean just skating when five people are trying to knock you down, but moving to where the puck is going rather than to where it was. Yeah. That's how you do the leading science as well, getting to, not just following the crowd, but going, being brave enough to go to a place where others haven't been.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there is, and if there are hockey fans in the audience, they remember, maybe 10 years ago, New Jersey used to run this trap system, and it's kind of, trapping light, trapping players. I don't know if it's... if they drew inspiration from you or what. So I guess the other thing that, although I haven't seen it a lot yet in our two kids, but the people tend to go through a rebellious phase, and I think that's true of scientists as well. Sometimes you're rebelling against your PhD supervisor, you're trying to establish yourself as having independent thoughts. Did you find yourself going through that at some point?
Yes. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, I actually didn't get to do what I intended when I accepted their offer. And I actually worked with a visiting faculty member. And that's how I got into this subject, because he really encouraged me to go off and try something completely different. So it was not that I was rebelling. I just didn't get into the crowd that I wanted to in the first place. Yeah. And that turned out to be the best thing that happened, actually.
Yeah, so serendipity plays often plays a role.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So we're talking a little bit about the earlier days now, maybe a step forward to when you were an undergrad at mm-hmm. MIT and experienced, I guess, the nightmare of every... frosh student to be called up to the front of the class to solve a problem in front of all your peers. Yeah. Maybe tell us a little bit about how that occurred and whether that changed you in any particular way.
That was actually conducted by our former president at U of T, who had come to MIT as a new faculty member, Bob Bergeneau. That was a long time ago. It was a different mindset and situation. Let me put it this way. Back in those days, they hadn't invented student-based course evaluations. So problem at MIT was that in those days, there were probably about 300 entering freshmen who all thought they're going to become professional physicists. And the first midterm exam reduced that by about 50%. And maybe it was good that Bob asked me to come to the board a few times. It was quite an experience, I'd have to say. I don't think that I would do that in my class today. There probably wouldn't be anyone left in the class. And I'd be happy if there were volunteers to do it. I don't think there would be any. I would do it in such a way that, I'd be working out the problem and I would invite advice on how I should solve the problem. So I think our aim is to nurture rather than intimidate.
Yeah, the carrot works better than the stick, usually. And I don't know if you've noticed in science in general or in your classroom, but the one thing's for sure in this fabulous building, shows it off in hidden little ways with the amount of information that students trying to become young scientists today are inundated with and have access to. It's almost overwhelming. Do you feel like the next generation of scientists are going to be different because of having to manage this overwhelming amount of information?
I think it is going to change and it already is changing how science is done. I mean, in the time when I was a student or a postdoc, if I wanted to get into a new field, I'd go to the library, ask the librarian to do a computer search of the literature, and she'd give me a printout, and then after that I'd go to all the journals on the shelf. Now we can do that in, you know, minutes, basically, sitting at our own desk. So certainly the access to information is going to change things. It can also be very distracting. There are a lot of other things you can be doing with your little devices, and my own son is an expert in that field. But the availability of information is going to do a lot of things, I think, in terms of where scientists even choose to work. No matter where you are, you can access the experts now. You don't have to be in one of the so-called elite institutions to do the best research. And, maybe the next Einstein would prefer to live here in Calgary than in Princeton, New Jersey, because, you know, all the information is available.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. Or maybe the next Nobel laureate, who happened to have a really good time here for a couple of days, will move to Calgary.
Well, you're already here. What are you talking about?
Please. we're kind of getting there. A couple of more, maybe they're philosophical questions, maybe they're not. Certainly, with this increase in accessibility to information, I'm hoping that the general public is becoming more aware of what's going on in science. And that means that society maybe demands more directly of us to solve their problems. That's been an underlying, I guess, end goal for many of the scientists, but it's more direct now. Do you feel that in your work? Do you feel the pressure of society? You've already given a couple of really excellent examples of applications.
Yeah. I know some of the funding agencies that have put a little bit of pressure along those lines to solve some very practical problems. I mean, I was once forced by an agency to find an industrial partner in my field. And, 20 years ago, that was really hard, and especially when you're restricting yourself to Ontario to find someone who's working on optical computers based on photonic crystals. So actually, I tried to be creative, and I made a linkage with the McDonald's hamburger company. And we got samples of their oil, and we actually built a device that could test the quality of cooking oil and when they should change it. Yeah.
So that's, yeah. Still eat at McDonald's?
If you're going to eat there, you should eat on Tuesdays. I learned that because they change their oil on Sundays.
Nice.
Mondays it doesn't taste good because the oil is too fresh. So.
Right. Yeah. Remember that? It needs to be conditioned a little bit. Excellent. So it's arguable. Either scientists admit this to themselves or they don't. But at some point, we all dream of winning the Nobel Prize. Some recognition that what we've done actually has big time impact. Yeah. And the audience may not know that you've been nominated a couple of years ago. Did that lead to any sleepless nights around the time of the announcement?
I basically don't think it's worth losing sleep over anything. So now, it seems that you know something that I don't, because what I know is that these nominations are secret.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Busted.
I think, in 2011, something did happen. And that was this news agency, Thomson Reuters, makes their annual predictions on who they think should win the Nobel Prize. And it turned out that I appeared on that list, which was much to the joy of my university administration. And a few funny little things happened, like people offering to show up at 5 a.m. in their office or something. So it appears that a few people may have lost some sleep that night, but I think in the process they learned a good lesson too.
So, I mean, I got my information directly from a Google search, I'm
sure.
Oh,
that's so reliable.
Completely accurate.
Must be true.
So far you've had a fabulous, productive career, pushed back the frontiers. It's, you know, by no means heading into the twilight zone, but is there a new problem that you've got working on the back of your mind?
Yeah.
And realizing, I guess, that this could be podcasted out to the universe, so you need to protect it a little bit. But is there life beyond photonic band gap materials?
I've always been saying to myself, I really need to work on something other than photonic crystals. So I tried high temperature superconductors for a while, but the reception was not all that great there. So you know, every time I do try to say to myself, I should work on something different, some new application of photonic crystals appears. So, you know, recently it was solar energy, and I think the next one is going to be this lab-on-chip medical biosensor. So, yeah, I do try, but I haven't succeeded yet at extricating myself from this.
Yeah. Ironically trapped.
Yeah, I've trapped myself, yes.
So I think it's probably time to open it up to the audience. There will be a couple of people on the sides running around with microphones. If you feel like you've got good lungs and want to just yell out your question, feel free. And I will moderate you, so please behave to the best of your ability. So we open it up to the floor.
Banner, curiosity. Our cells make vitamin D. Do they capture light? And the other thing is a chloroplast.
Yeah.
Does it capture light in the same way that you've illustrated here?
Yeah, there is certainly some interaction with light, and light is, sunlight is essential. If we don't get any of it, then we won't look the way we do. But in terms of trapping light, the way I'm talking about, biological materials simply don't have the scattering strength to trap it. What happens is that the light enters the tissue, it's either absorbed or it's just reflected back out. So it's not really trapped in the sense that I'm talking about, it's just, you know, trapped in a different sense of just being absorbed and converted into some other form of energy. Yeah.
Thank you. Right there.
As someone working in the area of discrete geometry, my question is about the geometry of the crystals that are able to trap light. So do we have an understanding of the type of crystal structures that are able to trap light? So do we have a sort of a characterization that tends to work in general?
Yes, that's a very good question. And the answer is that it turns out after, you know, many years of searching for what is the best structure, the diamond lattice structure is what we try to mimic. So it's basically two face-centered cubic lattices that are penetrating each other. And that's been one of the challenges in making or synthesizing photonic crystals. How do you create a diamond-like crystal with each unit having billions of atoms and make it to such a high degree of perfection? So yeah, that's a very insightful question. And it took several years after the initial proposal of photonic crystals to understand that that was the solution to the problem.
Thank you very much.
I think I saw another hand somewhere. Well, I see lots of hands. Oh, right beside, there we go.
I'm wondering what it costs to make these things.
Okay, that's also a very good question. Initially, when photonic crystals were being made, it was done on a different wavelength scale. You could actually build it on a, you know, a big model like this. And it was done for microwave, so it was done by hand. And that's a very slow, laborious process, drilling holes. And then the people that do standard semiconductor microlithography got in, and they would etch patterns on thin films of silicon and stack them on top of each other. That's the so-called woodpile structure. Again, a very expensive process. That's when I got some of my materials chemistry friends involved, Jeff Ozen at the University of Toronto, to see if we could find a way of doing it by the method called self-assembly, using the forces that nature already provides us with to see if we could coax certain sets of silica spheres, opals as they're called, to just condense into the right lattice structure. And we found a way of doing it and to infiltrate that material with silicon using chemical vapor deposition. And that was one of the pictures that I showed. And that's something that, you know, could be made for pennies, basically, rather than tens of thousands of dollars using semiconductor microlithography. And we're now moving to, as David suggested, using optics, using light interference in a polymer to make the material, to make the structure, and then replicate it into silicon. That would also be very inexpensive.
And then the other thing I was wondering is, you were talking about for the solar application, how if you have a very thin layer that it, and you can bounce the light around inside that layer, that you can slow it down enough that it, more of it will become absorbed, or more of it will find its way to complete the circuit, I guess, is more it. And, you know, oh, don't be me. I mean, I'm just a geologist, right? But I'm thinking if you slow light down like that, is it light anymore?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not slowing down, perhaps, in the sense that you're thinking. It's just that when light makes one or two steps forward, it makes one step backward, and then so on and so on. So it's still moving at the speed of light, but it's bouncing so much that its effective speed is slowed down.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Okay.
And so the, by the way, I also really like the illustrations here. It's very nice. But and you say you're solving Maxwell's equations,
yes,
which is the classical theory of light. Now, the idea of a band gap structure in a semiconductor is a quantum mechanical idea. But this trapping that you have, is it really just classical concepts that are made possible, that are sort of advanced because of your ability to manipulate the materials?
Yeah, this is purely a classical effect. And as you mentioned, we are looking to something that involves quantum mechanics. And really, the analogies have gone back and forth. Where did quantum mechanics come from? It came from looking at analogies with electromagnetism, classical waves, how they interfere. And people decided that, okay, in order to explain experiments with matter, we have to attribute that type of wave character. So now we've sort of turned the analogy back around and found something in quantum materials such as semiconductors and reproduced that back into optics and found the way to trap light.
Yeah. I saw a hand at the back there. Yeah. Brave one. Careful, you're at the back, so you might be asked to come up and solve Maxwell's equation.
I'll be okay with that.
So, come on up then.
Let's see it. to keep safe, my question is about education. So you mentioned that you had to like make up your mind between hockey and medicine and engineering. So clearly you're capable, and you also mentioned a really nice, smooth analogy between hockey and your philosophy towards research. So you seem to have this ability to think beyond boundaries, to explore analogies, and not necessarily in the sense of interdisciplinary research, but also like just applying some principle that is usually used in a different field to something that's entirely different. So I, for one, think that conventional education, like the existing system of education, discourages that sort of thinking. It tends to imprint boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, you think of something as being physics or being math or being chemistry or something. So you don't usually learn to think beyond boundaries. So how did you develop this way of thinking? And do you think there's something that can be changed about the system of education that could help?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I started with a very traditional physics education, and then it sort of expanded beyond the borders after I really understood how to do physics. I think it is very important in our educational system to teach, you know, what are the basic laws of nature, rather than immediately jumping to great leaps of creativity. We have to know what is legitimate creativity and what is not. So, you know, I can be very, very creative, but if it violates the laws of physics, it's just completely wrong, right? So, yeah, I would certainly encourage that we continue this the sort of discipline of learning what is in our own subject area, but at the same time, you know, giving a little bit more of the personal, perhaps the historical perspective of the people behind it. What were they thinking when they did it? And so that it doesn't become such a dry subject, because they bring in their own personal life experiences into what they're doing, and how they discovered things is part of a reflection of that life experience that goes beyond just the scientific training. Yeah.
If I can just take a moment to do a commercial for some of the things we're doing in the Faculty of Science as far as education goes. This is exactly what we're trying to break down as a strictly dogmatic approach to understanding science and making it more discovery-based. Agreed, you have to do the scales before you can play the riff. But you should know what a riff is. You know, you have to listen to Jimmy Page. So, you know, you have to have seen interesting science and be encouraged in the classroom to ask those questions that go outside of the boundaries. And I agree with you that I think that we can do much more of that, and we're trying that in a number of programs in science. And the students, not surprisingly, are loving it.
Indeed. Thank you for your fantastic talk. Your work seems highly interdisciplinary. I mean, you involve physics, chemistry, and now medicine. What strategies do you personally employ to work effectively across such a breadth of fields?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, my first advice is just be prepared to expose your ignorance a little bit. I mean,
or a lot.
if I were to, you know, collaborate with David, he would quickly figure out that I don't know nearly enough chemistry, and I'd have to trust him to work with me through that. And I think that's a lot of the way in which discoveries are made. You take yourself outside of your own comfort zone, and you know, despite all the training that you've had, you're in a situation now where you have to learn things from scratch, and that's where you correlate observations and make new discoveries that other people haven't already seen before. So that's one aspect of it, and then if you're going to work with a team, as with any team, you don't start thinking about, you know, if it succeeds, who gets the credit? I mean, that can also be debilitating.
Yeah, but it answers our other student's question too, that breaking down the boundaries and preparing to be uncomfortable, yeah, too, and you, without understanding everything. Okay, there's maybe one or two more questions. I'm starting to spy a little bit of nausea at the back there, and it's distracting me. So, and there will be opportunities to ask more questions too, but a couple more from the audience before we break it down.
Okay, you invited me to expose my ignorance, so here goes. As I listened to your talk, I got the sense that what you're looking at with lab on chip, biosensors and so on, is very, very application-specific chips. And as I say, this may be my misperception from your talk. is it application specific so much because it's driven by institutional factors of research funding, or is that something inherent in the technology? Or on the other hand, have I got completely the wrong end of the stick, and is the potential in this for extremely low heat, low power consumption, supercomputer, general purpose chips arising out of this technology?
Your question is, why am I going after these sort of practical applications, well, or which ones that I'm more interested in?
Is the technology itself driving it towards application specific
push or pull
chips, or is the potential for general purpose supercomputers arising out of this technology?
I mean, you could say that there's probably not a market right now for these supercomputers that run on light, but it is something that the laws of physics have now shown that in principle it is possible. So, I mean, it's sort of a personal preference to see how far that can be pushed. And if you ask me who's leading the game on that, it's probably some of the big labs in Japan that are the furthest ahead in that particular application. For me personally, you know, I'm not necessarily pushed or pulled. This is just my personal preference. I've been working on the fundamental side of things for so long that I really enjoy seeing a real-life practical application coming out of it. And of course, there's the other advantages of funding and so on that come with it.
Thank you.
Uno Mas, yes. Our lucky player in the back.
Just a quick question. So we've talked about static arrays, and a lot of what I've seen have been these sorts of structures. What about the possibilities of dynamic arrays where you can reconfigure the structure? Is it really a matter of being able to do this in a very controlled way because this relies on an interference effect?
Yeah, actually, he's a very innovative scientist. He's thinking ahead and suggesting things that were part of discoveries that actually have taken place in this field. So, yeah, I mean, moving parts are very important, and one of the ways that we've done it is to infiltrate these stationary silicon-based photonic crystals with a material that you can move, like a liquid crystal. So there you can apply a field, you can reorient the liquid crystal, and that changes the properties of the photonic crystal as well. And so you could have reconfiguration of circuit paths and things like that. So. Yeah, that's a very good insight, and if you had thought of that 10 years ago, you would have written a PhysRev letter on the subject, I think.
It won't be your last great idea, guaranteed. So I think we're going to invite Brian Kay back up to wrap things up, but hang around and save your applause for a couple minutes, I guess.
Okay, well, thanks very much, David and Sajeev, for your presentation, conversation, and answering questions from the audience. On behalf of everyone, we'd like to congratulate once again for being honored with the Killam Prize and for taking the time to come out to Calgary and to share with us your insights and your science. So please join me in thanking Dr. John for joining us.